Well, good morning, Oregon. I'm Finn J.D. John, and this is the Offbeat Oregon History Podcast, which every weekday brings you another story from the archives of the Offbeat Oregon History syndicated newspaper column. A new column gets added to the archives every Friday, you know, and today's Friday, so this story is brand new. Well, sort of. You know, the newspapers get these columns exclusively for 2 months, so I can't post them on offbeatoregon.com until those 2 months have gone by. Well, for this story, they've just gone by. So it just went live on the website today, and I'm going to read it to you now. Thank you very much for loading me down and queuing me up, and I hope you enjoy this show. This is the story of the rise of the House of Klux, how the KKK took over the state of Oregon from the inside out. The secret society of anonymous xenophobic vigilantes spread through Oregon society like a virus in 1922. And by the time elections were held that year, it was ready to seize the reins of power. And it didn't lose much time in doing so, but it would not keep them for long. The fall of the House of Klux is what we'll be talking about next week. This article was first published on April 21st, 2013. Here we go. There was something shockingly sudden about the Ku Klux Klan's seizure of the reins of power in Oregon in 1922. Within a few months of Klan evangelist Luther Powell's arrival in southern Oregon, the, quote, invisible empire had spread through Oregon society like a virus. Tens of thousands of Oregonians had paid their $10 membership fee and had their white eye-hole suits hanging in their closets, and tens of thousands more looked upon the secret society as a positive thing. It's important to understand that the Klan in 1922 was different from the Klan in 1866. The 1922 Klan had arisen out of D.W. Griffith's 1915 movie, The Birth of a Nation, which glorified the Klan and gave the group its iconic robe and pointy headpiece look, and also introduced the practice of cross-burning. Then, after the war, an advertising agency took the Klan on as a client and crafted its public image and its sales message with the manipulative skills that were honed in the First World War propaganda campaigns of the Creel Commission, and you know the results were striking. The original Klan, in the 1860s, had targeted freed former slaves and their white allies. It was quickly shut down in the early 1870s after leaving a trail of bloody corpses and terrified survivors strewn about the countryside. It was a scary, scary organization. By contrast, this new Klan would be, if you will, a kinder, gentler terrorist organization. It would last a little longer. And for a few years, it would seem destined to take over because the agency took its message down a notch and broadened it. It now appointed itself as the enforcement arm of white American Protestantism, ready and willing to undertake anonymous vigilante actions as needed to preserve white American Protestantism as the definitive American culture. Non-WASPs, that is, black people, Chinese and Japanese folks, Jews and Catholics, were to be kept under control as a matter of cultural self-defense. You know, melting pot, schmelting pot. With an eye on public relations, this new Klan controlled the level of vigilantism and terrorism very carefully, seeking that perfect level of edgy, attractive muscularity while avoiding becoming extreme enough to threaten mainstream society. Crosses were regularly lit afire in spots where they overlooked Catholic, Jewish, and African-American neighborhoods. They barged into Catholic churches during services dressed in their sinister anonymous eye-hole suits. They honored their organization's long-established tradition of lynching innocent people by conducting necktie lynchings, in which victims were led to believe they were about to die and lifted an inch or two off the ground by the neck for a moment and then released with a dire warning. This went badly for them on at least one occasion in Oregon when their victim, a white guy they suspected of having seduced a 16-year-old girl, figured out who they were and sued them. The new Klan also had designated a sales system of astonishing sophistication. Each recruiter, or Kleagle, got a standard kit. In addition to the usual stuff like contracts and eye-hole suits to sell the new recruits, the kit included a prospect list. Kleagles were encouraged to discreetly make contact first with Protestant pastors and then target cops and local government officials for membership. Then the ads would be placed in the newspapers and the Kleagle and or an especially enthusiastic local pastor would arrange a dog and pony show in some hotel ballroom in which the entire community was invited to come hear all about the Klan. Since the Klan was a secret society, the promise was that you could find out what all the hubbub was about by coming to one of these things. And the people who arrived were then played masterfully by the recruiter, who would finish the evening with sometimes hundreds of new $10 memberships, $4 of which, if he was a top-level Kleagle, he got to keep. In due course, the Kleagle would identify and deputize sub-Kleagles to go out and repeat the process at other towns. Klan membership would spread virally until any man in the state who thought he might want to be a Kluxer had the opportunity to pay his $10 and take home his very own clown suit. As we know from last week, Luther Powell did a yeoman's job of working this system in Oregon. By the election season in 1922, the process had completed itself and Oregon was shot through from one side to the other with Kluxers. These local Klan groups immediately got busy packing school boards, city councils, and county commissions with friendly faces. In Salem, the Klan found a ready ally in the fortuitously named legislator Casper K. Kubley, who soon became a member. Because Republicans at the time dominated the state government, the Klan got involved at the party level in a campaign to purify its ranks. It got control of the Multnomah County Republican Party, and probably several others as well. Roman Catholic and Jewish office holders, as well as those the Klan thought just weren't friendly enough to its aims, quickly found themselves embroiled in primary battles with challengers who were clearly going to win. The state's Republican governor, Ben Olcott, was an outspoken and intransigent opponent of the Klan. He knew the stand he was taking would probably cost him the election, but he also knew that letting a secret society of anonymous xenophobic vigilantes take over state government would be an awful thing, and he refused to give the state anything less than his full effort to stop it. The primary election was a massive dogpile of victories for the Klan. There were just two high-profile losses. Olcott had been renominated, and so had Congressman Clifton Nesmith MacArthur. Yes, that Nesmith. He was the legendary pioneer's grandson. MacArthur was a four-term U.S. congressman whom the Klan had targeted for being too independent. No problem. The Klan simply shifted its endorsement to the Democratic Party's candidates in the fall, when the general election was held. The Klan would get both Olcott and MacArthur defeated in that election, replaced with men who were either Klansmen or at least friendly to the Klan's agenda. It would also get a law passed that more or less outlawed private schools in Oregon in a direct attack on the Catholic Church. And it would take over the Multnomah County Board of Commissioners. It was very nearly a clean sweep. Every race the Klan had taken an interest in had swung their way. Quote, "There is something new under the sun," wrote Waldo Roberts of the magazine Outlook at about this time. "Oregon, politically the most conservative and temperamentally the least romantic state west of the Rocky Mountains, is now under the control of the Ku Klux Klan." But not for long. We'll talk about that next week. Well, that's our show for today. This show is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. In addition to this podcast, it includes a weekly newspaper column, a daily RSS feed to catch on your smartphone reader, a Facebook page, a Twitter feed, and a couple other minor components, all accessible through our anchor page at offbeatoregon.com. Photographs and other images that go with today's show are also on offbeatoregon.com, along with full citations to the sources for this story. And while you're there, you can browse through more than 200 other articles written over the last 5 years, all organized by the date of publication. The podcast is covered under a Creative Commons license. For details, see offbeatoregon.com/cc. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band, atlasstringband.com, and it was written by Carmen Ficarra. I do this for learning and for fun, so I don't sell advertising and I don't ask for donations, but if you feel a need to make a donation, may I suggest you buy a copy of my book instead? It's called Wicked Portland, The Wild and Lusty Underworld of a Frontier Seaport Town, published by the History Press in 2012. You can order a signed copy if you like from the store link at offbeatoregon.com, but if you still have a local community bookstore in your town, I hope you'll consider buying it from them instead. It sells for $20. Finally, if you're ever in Corvallis, do drop me a line. Maybe we can grab a cup of coffee and talk history. I'm at finn@offbeatoregon.com. Don't be a stranger. Our next show will be coming your way at around 6 a.m. Monday morning. And until then, go fill up the rest of today and the weekend with good stuff. Bye now.